University of Pennsylvania. Professor Herman is the author of Atrocities in Vietnam, of which we have a few copies here. He is also the co-author of The U.S. Policy in Vietnam, The Strategy of Deception. He will talk about the comparison between the atrocities of the United States, the Arvin forces, and the NLF.
What I'd like to cover in this discussion is first how I got interested in the atrocities question, and then I would like to discuss the relative atrocities of the different forces, which we could classify in a variety of ways. And then I also want to consider the why atrocities and why differences in rates of atrocity for the different combatants in Vietnam. I got interested in atrocities essentially from the very beginning of the war because I saw early that this was a very important instrument of public management. In fact, in this little book that I put out, I have a little section on the role of atrocities, and I talk about atrocities management, by which I refer to the fact that atrocities are turned off and turned on like a water spigot in order to achieve certain ends of the government. This is not just true of the United States government, but we happen to be in the United States, and that's what we're mainly concerned with here. But observing the United States government in operation from 1965 onward, one could see that every time we got into difficulties, maybe some phony peace move was exposed, or maybe we suffered a slight military setback, on those occasions, all of a sudden, there would be a flow of captured documents and a flow of evidence that the NLF was engaging in various kinds of activities that could serve as a counterweight to the unfavorable propaganda that was coming forth because of these other unpleasant facts. This occurred pretty systematically. I also, of course, was impressed with the fact that these enemy atrocities were put forward as really very serious matters, things of compelling interest, with no concern whatsoever for atrocities which might be committed by us or might be considered carried out by Arvin. So at least as early as 1965, I started to gather data on relative atrocities. What were the Arvin doing, and what had they been doing previously? What were we doing? And I was, from 65 onward at least, thinking about these questions, collecting documents, talking to veterans, talking to people in the administration, talking to Vietnamese, and reading an awful lot of newspapers, including foreign newspapers. So I developed a very extensive clipping file of American papers, foreign papers, magazines, and I talked to a lot of people. So eventually I wrote a little pamphlet on the subject about 2 years ago. Then when Nixon started to use the bloodbath gimmick about fall of 1969, it was obvious that the atrocities management problem was becoming serious and that Mr. Nixon was going to play this game to the hilt. I decided that it was time really to pull all this together and put out something more substantial. So I worked for some months steadily pulling all these reports together and coming up with a book that focused heavily on a comparison of atrocities. Now, studying atrocities is a very difficult matter for a lot of reasons. One, of course, is that the data are not very accessible. If you're interested in civilian deaths, it's always been a difficult problem that the Pentagon isn't very interested in civilian deaths. So if you ever follow these subjects, you will know that some of the dove senators used to ask the Pentagon about how many civilians were being killed, and while they could give data down to the decimal point on Viet Cong killed and on places pacified and on incredible detail, somehow or other civilian casualties were never available, never credible casualty figures available. So one has had to piece together information on atrocities from a complex variety of sources. You have to read about from a lot of reporters, different reporters. You have to talk to a lot of people, especially people who have been there. And you have to get a hold of as many public documents as you can get hold of. The government does put out a steady flow of information, and a lot of it is valuable. In writing this thing, I tried to rely to a minimum on Vietnamese documents. The Vietnamese put out studies, and they put out figures on atrocities and killings and so on, and I have some of those, but I've tried hard to avoid using them to any substantial degree. I've tried very hard to rely on Western data sources. But the problem is not one that can easily be overcome. Another problem is defining atrocities. In the West, we like to try to define atrocities in terms as face-to-face killings. The idea that an atrocity could exist by dropping a bomb on somebody not readily accepted. So the definition of atrocities that you find in an awful lot of publications and official documents limits an atrocity pretty much to a case where somebody comes up and sticks a knife in somebody's back. If somebody shot at somebody else from a helicopter, that's not an atrocity. In other words, atrocities in official documents almost always refer pretty much to face-to-face killings, not impersonal killings, or not other forms of damage that may be inflicted from afar. Well, I obviously could not accept such a definition. Atrocities, as far as I use it, I use the term to mean the commission of war crimes that are officially recognized war crimes in international law. That's one. And secondly, deliberate attacks on civilians and their mode of existence that is not dictated by strict military necessity. Now that could fall under the first definition, but I like to make it explicit that deliberate attacks on civilians or their mode of existence that is not dictated by immediate military necessity, I consider also to be an atrocity. Now, atrocities can be classified in a lot of ways. In this little book that I wrote, I break them down as face-to-face atrocities and then impersonal atrocities. Face-to-face would include these things primarily: looting, torture. And the torture would include torture of prisoners and torture of civilians, killing of prisoners and killing of civilians, razing of houses and destruction of houses and villages. This sometimes is done on a face-to-face basis as opposed to an impersonal basis. Relocation of populations, forced transfers of populations. These are the main components of face-to-face killings, face-to-face atrocities. Then the impersonal types would include shelling, artillery shelling, bombing. It would include various kinds of weaponry that are used via artillery and bombing raids, and chemical warfare. Now, again, in the book, I tried to break these things down as between various kinds of comparison. I have a full chapter in which I compare the ARVN and the NLF. And then I have a full chapter that compares the NLF and the United States. Now, to turn for a moment to what exactly I found in this inquiry, first, with regard to the comparison of the ARVN and the enemy, and the NLF, I think one of the most significant things that I concluded from this inquiry is that our Vietnamese have for a long, long time committed more atrocities than the enemy. This, I think this is very significant because insofar as atrocities are used as an argument for justifying our presence, it collapses immediately if in fact our Vietnamese are committing more atrocities than the other side. But I think the evidence is really very overwhelming that our Vietnamese have been guilty of more serious atrocities in all the comparative dimensions than the NLF. Take first something like looting. I have a long section on looting. It's a famous fact that the Arvin is a plundering operation. I have citation after citation to the effect that the Arvin loots, and it's been looting since the Arvin was part of the French army. In fact, there was a famous little document in the New York Times, long article on a plundering operation by the Arvin. And then toward the end of this article, this reporter, Buckley, made the remarkable statement that this is not new, that in fact the reporters who were with him indicated that this is precisely the way the Arvin was behaving under the French, that there's been a complete continuity. They're looters. And if you read any of the literature on NLF behavior, it goes, almost all of it says the NLF punishes looters, the rape under the by NLF people is subject to very serious penalties, and they are under a stricter discipline code, and somehow or other they're more closely identified with the rural population, so that as far as looting goes, the discrepancy is tremendous. The Arvin has been a looting enterprise from the time of the French up to today. In terms of torture, again, the evidence is not too good on NLF torture, but the NLF is basically not looking for information. The Arvin has been looking for information. It's operating to a large extent in unfriendly territory, the countryside of Vietnam, and along with American forces, it's essentially a mercenary army, an internal mercenary army. And the stories go back way into the Diem period of Arvin torture practices. In fact, there's a quote, there's an excellent book that was written by Malcolm Brown, who was the head of Associated Press in Vietnam for many years. He wrote a book in 1964 called The New Face of War. In the course of that book, he says this: torture has been an adjunct to interrogation for many years in South Vietnam. The ding-a-ling method of interrogation involves connecting of electrodes from a generator to the temples of the subject or other parts of the body. In the case of women prisoners, the electrodes often are attached to the nipples. Another method involves the near drowning of the subject. Many soldiers enjoy beating up Viet Cong prisoners. The subjects of interrogation so often die under questioning that intelligence seems to be a secondary matter. This is the head of Associated Press in Vietnam back in 1964. And the evidence is pretty overpowering that torture, systematic torture, and people dying under torture has been going on under Arvin auspices for as long as the Arvin has existed. The same thing is true of, as I say, of killing of prisoners. It's an interesting fact, too, that the Arvin and the Diem government were the ones to introduce chemical warfare into Vietnam. This occurred back in 1961. The United States wanted to use it a little, but Diem urged that it be used in enemy territory, enemy country, meaning the countryside of Vietnam, so that the introduction of crop destruction and defoliation occurred with the warm concurrence of the government of South Vietnam to be used on its own territory. Same thing is true of bombardments of the countryside and the destruction of villages. Malcolm Brown in 1964 was describing in detail how sometimes the Arvin Air Force would blow up towns in order to cover up thievery of plunderers of the administration. They would steal, they would rob the villagers of taxes, then they'd call in an airstrike, and that would silence any criticism, potential criticism of their plunder. But the Arvin Air Force has been profoundly irresponsible in its bombing policies, and it bombs with alacrity practically anything under any provocation. There was a report on refugees put out by the RAND Corporation, written by a man named Ackland. Came out about, he did it in 1968, and he described some gruesome cases where Arvin families were destroyed by the Arvin Air Force. The Arvin Air Force, the Viet Cong would occupy a town, the Arvin Air Force would come in and blow the town to pieces, even though it was mainly occupied by friends of the Arvin. It was a most amazing spectacle for some of these refugees, and he particularly interviewed one woman who was the wife of an Arvin soldier whose five children were killed by Arvin pilots. Well, why is that? By what logic could the Arvin be greater terrorists and atrocity creators than the NLF? Well, the answer really is very elementary and basic. The Arvin is really not drawn from the peasantry. At least if we go back to the period before Vietnam was completely demoralized, the Arvin was essentially a bought army, and it never fought well, and it was really hired by a government that was widely admitted not to have any significant support, especially among the 80% of the population that was peasants. You had a Mandarin government which acknowledged no significant indigenous support. That government couldn't mobilize an army that was dedicated to itself. It had to buy an army or coerce people into the army. And it has never fought well. It didn't fight well under the French, and it doesn't fight well today. And ultimately, it traces back to the fact that the government is not a representative government. Somebody just sent me, an Australian, just sent me a document that was written by John P. Vann, who was one of the two top pacification officers in South Vietnam. This document was written in 1965, just a little after we had escalated the war. And it's an internal army document that describes what the truth is about the situation in Vietnam and what we have to do. And because it's an internal document, it's really quite remarkable what it says. The main thing it says is that the government that we're supporting has no serious indigenous support in South Vietnam. That does present a problem. This is John P. Vann, Chief Pacification Officer of the American government in South Vietnam. A popular political base for the government of South Vietnam does not now exist. That's a remarkable statement. Theoretically, we were there to help these people attain self-determination and so on, all complete baloney, and here acknowledged in an internal memo by a leading pacification officer to be complete baloney. He has a number of other statements along the same line, but in fact at the beginning, this paper is based on the assumption that a military defeat will not occur and that opportunity will continue to exist to win the majority of the South Vietnamese to the side of a non-communist government. Notice the language. It implies that the population is not with this government, but we still have time to win support for this non-communist government. This document is full of admissions like that. In fact, I put out a document a couple years ago which assembled statements of this sort, which I'm now revising. But a very basic fact to understand anything about our war and the position of the Arvin is that the Saigon government that we have supported has always been a tiny little minority government with no significant indigenous support, and its army has been a mercenary army. Another thing that I think is really important to understand, too, is that the government is one of the most corrupt governments in the world, and that this corruption comes down to the lower order, too. In fact, I want to read you this statement by Senator Edward Kennedy, who has been the Senate expert on refugees and who has had a lot of dealings with the Saigon government, and who wrote a report called Civilian Casualty and Refugee Problems in South Vietnam, Findings and Recommendations, in 1968. In that report, he says, this is Senator Kennedy, corruption pervades all aspects of Vietnamese life and is brazenly practiced. Government jobs are bought and paid for by people seeking a return on their investments. Police accept bribes. Officials and their wives run operations in the black market. Aid funds and hospital supplies are diverted into private pockets. Each refugee is supposed to receive the equivalent of $45 for resettlement. It was estimated to me by a U.S. official advisor to the refugee program that 75% of this amount is siphoned off before it reaches these people. In the field of refugee care and in many other fields, the government of South Vietnam has been engaged in the systematic looting of its own people. That's a Senate report, statement of Senator Edward Kennedy. He also says they are truly colonialists in their own nation. This is the Saigon government being described by Senator Kennedy. So given the nature of this government, its lack of indigenous support, its the fact that it has thus been forced to hire a mercenary army and pacify its own people, we have enough reason why the atrocities level carried out by these mercenaries would be very high. One additional fact worthy of note is that the United States government has given them unlimited arms, so these mercenaries can careen over their own country and bomb and destroy at will. One last point on the comparison of the ARVN and the NLF. Almost all people who have ever studied the NLF have noted that the NLF uses terror. Yes, it uses terror, but it uses it selectively. This was particularly true, say, before 1967. All serious scholars of the NLF have said that the primary emphasis of the NLF is on political education. They use terror. They kill people. They kill people for demonstration purposes. They kill collaborators. But the killing is secondary. If you look at the history of the ARVN and the Diem government, you understand that education and reform are secondary. What is first is the military solution. So with the ARVN, with the Diem government, you have the military first, politics second. With the NLF, everybody admits politics comes first. Terror is a secondary adjunct. As is. Let me turn now to the question of U.S. versus NLF atrocities. This is a very big subject. And I'm only going to really give you my conclusions on the subject. Again, face-to-face killings. If we compare the United States and the NLF in terms of face-to-face killings of civilians, it seems to me we have a the evidence is that we have a substantial superiority to the NLF, even on face-to-face killings. If you go to torture and killing of prisoners, we have a very large margin of superiority because the NLF and DRV have not collected many prisoners. When they get American prisoners, they almost never torture them or kill them. In fact, it's been an embarrassment to the United States government that NLF taken prisoners have been treated a little too well, and many of them have come back and they've had to be debriefed. There have been so many of them that have said they're not going to be able to fight anymore after the way they were treated, that the United States government now has a policy of a debriefing period for all ex-NLF prisoners. They undoubtedly have killed, and especially Saigon government soldier prisoners, but they have not taken as many, and their policies are not such as to take a lot of prisoners. We have taken tremendous numbers. We have policies of going into areas with country fairs surrounding them, killing all fleeing men, taking significant numbers of prisoners. The men are frequently interrogated, then they're turned over to the Arvin. And the evidence of the testimony of an awful lot of Vietnam veterans now is that the torture of enemy prisoners and suspects is commonplace, and an awful lot of them are killed. As far as village destruction goes, village raisings, we have read about a number of cases where the NLF and the DRV have destroyed villages. There were a couple of famous ones that got a lot of publicity. But the fact of the matter is that they've been rare. The NLF and DRV have sometimes destroyed villages or at least damaged them when the citizens have told the Americans where they're located and divulge significant information. But I don't think there have been a half a dozen cases reported in the American press in the last 3 years. There have been something like 5 cases. Now, if you read the papers, you know that the American government has had a systematic policy of burning down villages in enemy-held territory. The Zippo Squad is now in the language. The Zippo Squad is a squad of American soldiers assigned the duty of burning down a village. It's been systematic. And there must have been at least 2,000 villages in South Vietnam that have been deliberately burned to the ground. The only ones that I've heard of that the NLF and DRV have burned to the ground, a total something like a half a dozen over the last 5 years. There may have been others. As far as air and artillery activity go, obviously there's no comparison. The NLF has thrown a few rocket shells into Saigon and other cities, but anybody who studies this subject at all recognizes that we're dealing with fantastically different orders of magnitude when we talk about our bombing and shelling and their bombing and shelling. They don't have any airplanes. I made a computation. In fact, I have a table in this book of relative ordnance expenditures. Because the Army was kind enough to give me estimated figures on what ordnance the NLF and DRV used for a 3-year period. They used, from 1967 through 69, the NLF and the DRV used an estimated 17,500 tons of explosives, according to computations which I made based on intelligence estimates given me by the Defense Department. In that same period, we used something like 5 million tons. I calculated the ratio exactly, and it came to something like a ratio of ordnance expended by us and them of 450-1. So you're dealing with totally different orders of magnitude. If they had used all their shells to bomb cities, they still wouldn't have bombed cities on the scale that we do in a month. So by any calculation of atrocities that are related to relatively indiscriminate use of bombs and shells, we've got them beat by a margin that is fantastically large. Then you have to consider the fact that the United States is, again, using chemical warfare all by itself. We've been engaging in crop destruction, defoliation for years and years, enormous quantities, and we've been using advanced weapon systems, many of which probably are illegal according to rules of law. the fragmentation bomb, which has been used very heavily, is at least in the modes in which we have used it against civilian sites, almost certainly involved in war crime. We also have engaged in a fairly systematic bombing of all kinds of infrastructure sites. In North Vietnam, dikes have been bombed pretty systematically. This was particularly true in 1966. We bombed hospitals systematically. You may not believe that, but it's an absolute fact that, and I muster up a fair amount of evidence, hundreds and hundreds of hospitals have been bombed. Many of them have been marked with Red Cross signs, and in fact, the North Vietnamese have stated that after a while, they decided they had made a serious mistake putting Red Cross signs on hospitals because that attracted bombing, and they terminated that operation. But literally hundreds of hospitals in North Vietnam were bombed, and the American government's, in fact, Spiro Agnew, our vice president, in a speech which he made just at the time of the Cambodian invasion, said that one of the purposes of the Cambodian invasion was to destroy enemy supplies and medical complexes. Now, if you read the Geneva Convention of 1949, it's very explicit that under no circumstances are you to attack either mobile or fixed enemy medical complexes. Here we talk all the time about the Geneva Convention of 49, and here is our very vice president telling us that the purpose of the Cambodian invasion was to violate the a part of the Geneva Convention. Well, this brings me to the last question I want to address myself to just for a moment. Why? Here, I'm arguing that in terms of almost every dimension of atrocity, we have a large edge over the enemy. Why? Well, one reason is our people attitude. I guess most of you have heard of the Mir Gook rule. The Mir Gook rule is a rule that was described by lawyers in Vietnam, military lawyers, to describe why penalties against people who had done something rather onerous to Vietnamese were remarkably low and systematically low. The whole attitude structure of us toward them is bad. They're little yellow people, they're poor, we're able to push them around, and it's very easy to develop a contempt for them. I'm not one who believes that the war was started as a racist war, or that I think that the concept of racist war is a very obscure concept. But I do believe that the fact that they are little yellow people and poor and has helped things along. It's made it extremely easy to regard them as highly expendable. And therefore, the low valuation of these people who have become really our instruments and tools, the Mir Gook rule writ large is what dominates American policy toward Vietnam. These people are of no consequence. And in fact, when you read the speeches of Mr. Nixon and other of our leaders, they talk about American casualties. And Vietnamization means letting the gooks die, killing other gooks. The whole thing has a kind of racist tone, although I don't think the cause is racist. Still, they're only lousy little gooks, and we want to let them fight among themselves instead of letting valuable American boys die. Another very important thing related to this is that from a political standpoint, Vietnamese don't count in America. They have no constituency here. There was a sign that I saw a couple years ago, a protest sign that said, "Make South Vietnam the 52nd state," or something like that. The idea behind it was give them a little representation. No genocide without representation. They need a constituency. They don't have anybody in the United States who has their interest at heart, except altruists. So I think that's an important consideration. Therefore, Mr. Nixon is worried about our casualties. What is troublesome about the war is not Vietnamese deaths, it's that our casualties are too high. And therefore, if Mr. Nixon can lower them to acceptable levels, then everything is okay. Well, what's the implication of that? It's the Mir Gook rule. if mere gooks are dying, that's of no concern to us, really, and it has no political consequences in the United States, except among a couple of bleeding hearts. Another fact about why our atrocities in Vietnam is severe, I'm saying the first fact, is that they're little poor yellow people without representation in the United States. Therefore, the mere gook rule applies. The second fact, fundamental fact, is that our side has no indigenous support, or very little. And we're fighting, therefore, in a hostile population. We need information. Our soldiers go into the countryside, and they find that people are sullen. Maybe even little children occasionally throw bombs at them. And pretty soon, it's recognized that this is a hostile population, and they become treated as a hostile population. So there's a transformation process in which this hostile population is ultimately transformed into an enemy population de facto in terms of our policies. Then a third consideration is that we have carried out a whole number of official policies determined in Washington and Saigon that in themselves involve the commission of serious atrocities. The B-52 bombing on a program basis, retaliatory bombing, harassment and interdiction, artillery strikes at villages, free fire zone definitions, the use of chemicals, Zippo squads, the deliberate generation of millions of refugees, the use of gas, and a whole series of very ugly weapons, all in themselves involve kinds of atrocities. Now, given that background, given official atrocities, the idea that this is not going to help in this, to cause our individual soldiers to take a very cavalier attitude toward the Vietnamese is showing a lack of good sense. The official policy also has involved the acceptance of torture and killing of prisoners. So we have a structure of official policies that has consolidated these underlying attitudes and given the frustration of American soldiery, the development of a lot of face-to-face killing and a tremendous amount of impersonal killing has come as a matter of course. A fifth factor is technology. We're rich. We can afford to blow up the Vietnamese. We spend on ammunition the equivalent of the gross national product of all of Vietnam. So we can be extravagant. We can afford. We spend more on developing technology for killing Vietnamese than the whole gross national product of Vietnam. So it's partly a question of discrepancy in wealth. We are wealthy. We can afford to kill with extravagance. Another factor is, let me just say as the last factor, the fact that the Vietnamese cannot retaliate. In fact, I will close my remarks with just reading you the closing passage in this little book that I wrote, which discusses this point. In the last paragraph in this book says, finally, the unique scale and quality of our atrocities is partly a function of the fact that the enemy is weak and poor and is not able to retaliate in kind for the escalating catastrophe being imposed on his country by the United States. Given this purely defensive capability of the enemy and the feedback effect of the American assault, which creates a steady flow of new communists, it is evident that the Johnsonian, Nixonian, honorable solution has always contained the seeds and still poses the threat of a technologically based final solution. Does anybody want to raise any questions? Yes.
I think I would agree with you that the cause of the war is not racism. It's not a thing in itself, in other words. But I was wondering if you would care to make a few brief remarks on the motivation of our leaders for prolonging this thing. In other words, do they hope to get anything tangible out of it?
Well, he's asking about really why we're staying there. Of course, that has nothing to do with racism. I mean, some of our allies over there. I believe, you know, if you look at the German bombings that we carried out, it seems that we would be capable in conditions of war of rather indefinite killing of good Caucasians under the appropriate circumstances. I do think it helps push things along. But if one wants to explain why we stay there, it has to be much more complex than it. I don't think the racist element has any significant part of it. I think it unless it could be the loss of face to a little yellow people who would have been able to hold out against our expenditure of $250 billion and loss of 55,000 boys. That I've always felt that the longer we stay, the harder it is to pull out in that sense, that we get a bigger and bigger vested interest. All those boys died in vain. Of course, if we won, in my opinion, it would be much worse from the standpoint of any moral issue than if we lost. But our leaders find it hard to admit that. But we've built up an enormous set of vested interests, especially in Asia. We have all kinds of little client governments who urge us to stay. And we have a huge military bureaucracy that wants us to stay and win. They're having a marvelous time testing weapons, and they're all getting promoted. I mean, this is a godsend for the military bureaucracy, and they are permitted to call the shots. Nixon is a strongly military-oriented man. He loves generals and admirals, and he has a very difficult time telling them that they're scoundrels and liars. Even Johnson had difficulty doing that, big as his ego was. But Nixon is a weak little man, and therefore he's even more dangerous than Johnson. But you're asking a tremendously difficult question: why we're staying there. I'm giving you some reasons. There's momentum. It's politically difficult to get out. And the American political process is working badly, in that the big parties are not generating candidates who really are giving us any serious options. So what's happened is the war has pushed us politically further to the right, and we get a Nixon. Maybe next we'll get a Reagan, and he'll pave Vietnam over to solve the problem. But the political spectrum keeps altering unfavorably from the standpoint of peace, because we're getting more and more kooky people running the government. And that's not conducive to getting out. So that now, at this point, when a fair number of liberal businessmen and a fair amount of the business community would like us to get out, we're saddled with a military bureaucracy and a strong supporter of Goldwater in 1964, namely Richard Nixon in the White House. In other words, I can't answer your question very adequately. It would take a book to answer that question. Any other questions? Try an easier one.
What is
your
pamphlet, and is it in publication now and
available? Well, this little thing, I have it available if you want to buy a copy here. I'm a salesman. Atrocities in Vietnam, Myths and Realities, Pilgrim Press. I also have a couple of copies of a thing I'm revising now called Free Choice or Subjugation? Evidence that the faction supported by the United States in Vietnam has never been able to compete politically with the National Liberation Front. I'm putting out a revised edition of this in the next few weeks, but I think this is a useful document because the crucial argument always gets down to who are we supporting and what kind of indigenous support do they have? And this thing assembles an awful lot of quotes from American counterinsurgency experts and an awful lot of right-wingers. In fact, let me read you this quote will interest you. It was difficult for me, as it is for any Westerner, to conceive of a communist government genuinely serving the people. I could hardly imagine a communist government that was also a popular government and almost a democratic government. But this was just the sort of government the Pom Hut state actually was while the struggle with the French continued. The Viet Minh could not possibly have carried on the resistance for 1 year, let alone 9 years, without the people's strong united support. You know who said that? Joseph Alsop, in June 25th, 1955. He had just gotten back from a trip to Vietnam. This is before he became a lunatic. There are a lot of good quotes like that in here. I'm not trying to sell it. I don't have any copies of it, but any other questions? Yes, back there.
Why the reluctance of the media and the Congress to give more light to a hearing such as this? I mean, can you possibly the reason why?
Well, I don't know how efficiently we went about getting them here. You know, you need a certain amount of diplomatic skills. I've been associated with an awful lot of movement groups over the last 6 years, and it's an interesting thing. You've got to learn the ropes of how to get them here, for one thing. There's a technical problem. Do we call the right people? Do we approach them properly? Do we keep on their tail? That's part of it. There's also a problem of getting enough publicity so that they have to come, because there are going to be a lot of people here. And other than that, I guess they don't like this sort of thing because it's very unpleasant, and there have been a lot of these things going on. A lot of people are talking about atrocities and war crimes, and the media, they're kind of sick of the subject, and they're repelled by it. Now, I think that's Peter Weiss this morning. I think he didn't give enough emphasis to the fact that the things that we have to say are extremely unpleasant to ordinary American people, because they run counter to all their basic beliefs and their desire to love their country. So these things are repellent. People want to hide from these facts. And I think to some extent the media do too. Any other questions? Yes.
How can you say that racism really isn't a cause of our being over there? When we have had a philosophy known as a white man's burden towards Asians for hundreds of years, and many people have stated how the people over, you know, in Asia have to be civilized, how they have to be shown, our way of life. Couldn't you say in part that racism is a cause? There is an economic reason why we're over there.
I did give it some weight, but not much. I gave it weight in help making it easy to kill them on a large scale. It's true that we've dominated them, but to some extent, a lot of the attitude that we feel toward them is the attitude of the strong toward the weak, not necessarily the white man toward the yellow man. We have dominated the Orient, and we've pushed them around for a long time. So you tend to develop attitudes toward people based not necessarily on race questions, but on the fact that there is a dominance and subordination relationship. And I think that's an important part of the picture. Even if we wanted to guide them and lead them and felt that we were superior to them, we don't always rush in and spend $250 billion in order to permit ourselves to guide them. I mean, this is the most inane enterprise from the standpoint of American interest in Vietnam or interest in. In many ways, it's a highly irrational venture, and I don't think that our desire to patronize the Vietnamese could have very great weight there. You have a question?
Yeah, I'm just going to. It just seems that every time one asks sort of man on the street what we're doing in Vietnam, he says either we're stopping communism or we're helping people keep their democracy.
Yes.
And that doesn't quite square with what you just said.
Well, that's certainly very true. But certainly, especially the business of dealing with democracy. I mean, the fact that the man in the street says that shows that he's dealing in extremely primitive symbols, and it has no meaning. The Vietnamese situation has never been democratic. The idea that what we are doing in Vietnam has the slightest relation to democracy or self-determination is a joke. It's pure Orwell, because the United States first really got in there heavily when the French were trying to reestablish a colonial regime. Now, how could you reconcile the desire for democracy and self-determination with an initial strong, vigorous effort to permit a colonial power to reestablish colonial control over a subordinate? It's completely ridiculous. And then, of course, we supported a police state under Diem for a long, long time. That was an extremely ugly and repressive government, and that was not a democracy in any sense. And we've moved more and more toward the military junta. The United States, its favorite governments in the world are military juntas in the third world. The Brazilian dictatorship is really a pet. Once democracy was overthrown in Brazil in 64, our aid missions and our aid skyrocketed. And of course, the Greek junta is an ugly little tyranny, and we're in excellent relations with that Greek junta. So we are there for purposes of stimulating democracy is laughable. The ones that we support are the farthest away from democracy. And that we're there to stop communism, maybe that's true. That may be true, but communism we use very loosely. What is it that we are supporting positively? We're certainly not supporting anything reasonable. It's an againstness. All set? Well, the time has come to move on to the next phase of the program, so anybody that wants to ask me any questions afterwards, I'll be happy to do so.
Good afternoon. This next panel will be on forced relocation, taking civilians as hostages, mistreatment of civilians, and we have Ethel Taylor, who is a Greater Philadelphia Coordinator for Women's Strike for Peace, who has been to North Vietnam and has talked with South Vietnamese survivors of U.S. bombing. Due to a shortage of time and the fact that Mrs. Taylor has to leave soon, she will be our first speaker. Mrs. Taylor.
My report actually is the other side of the coin of what I imagine the Vietnam veterans will be discussing. The people to whom we have, on whom we have been committing these atrocities. I've met with Vietnamese people on many occasions, both from the North and from the PRG. These are my credentials. In May of 1968, I spent a week with Vietnamese women in Paris at a conference. In August of 68, we met in Toronto. And in December of 1969, I was invited to Hanoi with two other women. And at this time, we formed the Committee of Liaison with Families and Servicemen Detained in North Vietnam, which is the clearinghouse in this country for exchange of letters and information, as you know, between prisoners held in the North and their families. In 1969, I met with Ambassador Thuy in Paris to discuss the war and the details of our trip, and also met with the PRG. And I am in constant correspondence with the women of the Women's Union of North Vietnam. I mention all this in order to show that I have some competence to discuss the reaction and the testimony of the people who are suffering as a result of the war crimes of the United States in Vietnam. I'm glad to have this opportunity because my presentation today is an effort to give those people an opportunity to be heard so that we'll know them and those who were slaughtered by name, not just as a body count, not just as statistics, so that we will all realize, and we would hope that all American people will realize, that these are and were real people, flesh and blood, mothers, fathers, babies, adolescent girls and boys, not inscrutable Orientals who really do not care about life and their children the way we do. When I was in North Vietnam, I heard firsthand testimony by survivors of My Lai and Bay Lang On, and from a woman who had been imprisoned in Tu Duc prison as a political prisoner. And in 1968, I met with and spoke with and took testimony from a young girl partisan from South Vietnam whose activities in the partisans was precipitated by what the American soldiers had done to her family, and to her village. I am reporting to you only on the testimony that was given to me in person or handed to me with the names of the people involved as witnesses. But I have with me pages and pages of testimony and statements made by people in many of the villages which received this same kind of treatment. And I must admit that even though I am thoroughly convinced that the United States is the aggressor in Vietnam, I listened with horror to this testimony, and it strained my credulity. But it wasn't until I got home that the very things which had strained my credulity were verified for me. For instance, I had listened one afternoon to a man from the Peace Committee of the NLF describe the terrible birth mutations, the fusing of arms and legs of newborn babies, which they attributed to the chemical defoliant 245T. When I got home, I read a statement by Nixon's scientific advisor who admitted that in laboratory tests, rats injected with 245T gave birth to a preponderant number of deformed babies. Subsequently, an order was given to cease using this chemical, but recently it was disclosed that that order had not been carried out. I was also told in Vietnam the horrendous story about the rape and murder of a young Vietnamese girl who was taken from her hut where she was sleeping with her parents by three American soldiers. When I returned home, I read this documented story in The New Yorker, told by a fifth GI who was there but did not participate in the crime. The testimony of a 12-year-old survivor of My Lai who lost 18 members of her family was documented for me by the Cali trial. And it wasn't until last year when Congressman Anderson, Tom Hawkins, and Don Luce exposed the Khon San tiger cages that the American people knew they existed. I was told about them in 69 in Hanoi when I heard testimony from a South Vietnamese woman who had been imprisoned as a political prisoner. What sickened me even more than her description of the torture, the pouring of lime into eyes, nose, and mouth, the hanging by arms and beating, the forcing of sticks up genitals, was the damning fact that this prison was visited regularly by an American advisor, sometimes accompanied by his wife, who lived in a nearby villa. They came and they observed, but nothing was changed after they left. Madame Fong told me that the one thing that will forever be imprinted in her mind is the fact that she was kept handcuffed, and imprinted on these handcuffs was the stamp Made in USA. It was torture for me as an American to sit and listen to a 12-year-old child recount her terror at My Lai when 18 of her family were slaughtered. I tell you in part her testimony. I have her complete testimony here. She said they rushed into the shelter where I, my sister, and my grandfather and grandmother were and killed my grandmother. I hid in a corner and I fainted. When I awoke, I saw my grandfather's flesh splashed all around. I ran to another shelter and saw my five-year-old cousin. He was bayoneted. Mr. and Mrs. Mai were dead, both bayoneted. My uncle Mui was killed, and his daughter-in-law and her six-month-old baby were bayoneted. My aunt Mai had just delivered a baby the night before, and the GIs tried to rape her. They shot and killed her. They killed my aunt Fu and burned her baby. This is, I say, part of her testimony. And I have a letter signed by four other survivors of My Lai who substantiate Little Vo Ti Lien's testimony. This happened in My Lai, but the Vietnamese say that the same thing has happened in hundreds and hundreds of other hamlets. Madame Phuong said that even though My Lai happened under Johnson,